Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you might be listening. My name is Frank Duncan, and you're listening to Backfield Banter, a podcast about baseball, training, and really anything that covers sports. Welcome back. We're here today with Zach McLeod, Will Stevens, Bob Zimmerman. I'm Frank Duncan, and we're also welcoming today Mr. Shane Davies. Shane, you want to take a second and introduce yourself?
I'm Shane Davies, as assistant pitcher coordinator with Bob since end of 2016. Started here as an athlete my senior year of college, kind of right after they opened the first facility in KC. So I've been with Bob since end of 2015.
How Shane got hired is a great story because we had a pitching group at 4 o'clock and there were only four kids signed up for it. And so I was like, all right, I don't need any other instructors. So I was just handling on my own, and yet all the 5 o'clock kids came to it too. So there were like 17 athletes in it. And thank God Shane had just got done with his workout. And so I was just panicking, like, I don't know how to handle this many at once. And look over and Shane's done. And I was like, shit, can you help me out? He's like, yeah, I got you. Since there, he's been on, hired him on the spot, and we've been rolling.
As Bob says, Shane runs the show whenever Bob's not here. We also are welcoming back Trevor Jones, our head strength and conditioning coach here at Premier. Trevor, welcome back. We missed you.
Yeah, miss you guys too. Glad to be back.
Before we get started today, I'm going to let Zach McLeod introduce our guest today, Mr. Victor Cruz. Thanks for being here. Zach, take it away.
All right, Victor. You grew up in New Jersey, played baseball, ended up going to college at Rowan University, which is a D3, and then transferring after 4 years there to East Stroudsburg University at D2, where you received your master's in exercise science. Currently, you've been working with the Rays now in your fourth year, and you will be in AA in Montgomery, Alabama.
Go Biscuits!
Go Bit! Great name, by the way. In my senior year of college, we had our regional down there, and I think I bought a shirt that had the Biscuits. Tell us about growing up in New Jersey, your recruiting process, what's led you to the Rays, and what got you into the strength and conditioning field.
First of all, I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm stoked to be here. The first memories in life were playing catch with my pops in the backyard. I was a baseball guy from the jump. Ended up playing, high school baseball here in New Jersey where I grew up. Got recruited pretty late. I wasn't too talented in high school, and to be honest with you, too talented at all throughout my college baseball career. And all the opportunity and all the innings that I got, I really had to earn them. And, I was not an everyday starter for a lot of that time. But baseball is not only a game, but it also teaches about life. So I got a lot of lessons from that. So I got recruited late, committed to Rowan University, D3 school in New Jersey. Had a really nice career, won a ton of baseball games. Throughout my 6 years, we made at least the regional all of those years. Had a College World Series appearance at Rowan my senior year. And then after that was when I had my first, I guess you could say, professional strength and conditioning experience. I made the decision to stop playing summer ball like a lot of guys do when they're playing college baseball, and instead use my off seasons and the summer to pursue experiences in strength conditioning because it was something I fell in love with early on. I realized that there's stuff you could do off the field to get better on the field. So kind of got into it, and then I went to Cressy Sports Performance after my senior year at Rowan, and that was my first S&C experience. Spent the summer there, and then after that I walked on. Sounds better when you say grad transfer, but essentially I walked on at East Stroudsburg University. And after the first day of practice, head coach came up to me and shook my hand, and that was it. I was there for 2 years, got my master's in exercise science. I was also a graduate assistant strength conditioning coach there. And then in between my fifth and sixth year, I got my foot in the door, as they say, in professional baseball with the Rays, and spent my summer with the Rays as a strength conditioning coach. And after my baseball career finished up, kind of hit the ground running. Now I'm on my fourth year, like you said, and I'm excited to go down to Montgomery, Alabama this year, and it'll be my first year in AA.
Nice. Well, so you said you started out with your strength and conditioning career with Cressy. Obviously, Cressy is like one of the bigger names in the strength and conditioning world within baseball. How did that come to fruition when you were trying to get started in the business?
When I kind of fell in love with the weight room and saw the value of it, and just grew a passion for it, one of the first people that I came across was Eric Cressy, and I dove into his material early on. And I knew when the time was right and I wanted to start to move away from baseball and focus on my career, I wanted to go that route and learn some of the ways of how he's doing things, working with baseball players. So I had a pretty targeted plan, actually. So after my junior year, which was the big COVID year where we only played six games, I played summer ball that year in a facility in South Florida that actually has a partnership with Cressy Sports Performance, the gym. And so I played summer ball and I trained, you know, throughout the week at Cressy, some relationships there. And then the following summer, you know, applied for the internship. You know, I guess I was a kind of a shoo-in just because they knew I knew how the facility worked. And then had my summer there.
And so you get started at Cressy. What immediately stood out about Cressy to you?
Well, I guess the first thing is the caliber of athletes. I've never been around professional baseball players consistently. And then not to mention guys like Max Scherzer, Justin Verlander, Giancarlo Stanton. I remember the first day I got there, I saw Giancarlo Stanton running tempo runs with the shirt off in the outfield. And I was like, what just happened? Like, where am I? How is this happening? So there was a shock and awe factor just on the athletes you were seeing. And then another thing I'd say is, like, once I was done there, there was just this feeling of the more you know, the less you know. I learned so much about strength conditioning and different principles and different systems about how to train the human body that I ultimately left there and was like, wow, I am not even scratching the surface on how this stuff works and how to really get guys better. So I left there and I was like, I don't know what to do. That's the learning process. And sometimes you have to go through that.
So what were some of the principles you feel really like changed how your mind operated when you're training athletes and I guess specifically baseball athletes?
My perspective has changed over the course of time, as with anything, and you go throughout life. But at Cressy, one of the big things was the idea of individualization. And I think a lot of people talk about that now and it's getting more and more popular. But I just realized when I got there, an athlete doesn't just walk in and start squatting or start deadlifting. An athlete walks in and they get a full makeup of their movement and performance assessment. And a lot of people have different ways to track and look at some of those things. But Cressy's system has been workshopped and troubleshooted for, you know, almost two decades now. So it's really cool to see the product they have in terms of how they want to understand athletic movement. And then you take that assessment and you build out not only the weightlifting program and conditioning stuff, but also a very individualized warm-up based on that person's needs, whether it be, you know, hip mobility, T-spine mobility, force production, things of that nature. So I guess that's one of the big principles at Cressy is individualization and then their method of how to do it.
Do you feel like you've taken some of those principles you learned at that age and continue to carry them over? So like a little background on me, I was a high school coach and a college coach and did strength conditioning and hitting at all those levels. And when you get, you know, 50 guys in a weight room, you know, it's hard to individualize. As a strength conditioning coach at a professional level, how has that impacted the way that you're training a team?
Just to go back a second, like when I was at Cressy, right after I went to East Stroudsburg, which we talked about, and essentially I went to East Stroudsburg after learning these super individualized methods for high-level baseball players. And then I went to East Stroudsburg and I had the women's basketball and the women's swimming team. And, you know, these are Division II athletes that care about their sport and they're committed, but it's just a different level. And so I walked in there and I'm like thinking about, you know, hip internal rotation and how do I get someone to find their backside drive and this and that. And it's like, wait a second, like these girls don't care at all about any of that. So like it was a really hard learning curve trying to understand the differences between like team setting and then like more like personal training or one-on-one or like super individualized. So what I'd say is I learned through a lot of my failures, and you want to try to create systems around big groups, but you know, it takes time. So that's kind of an example or a story of like, yeah, that is a tough transition. And I think as you go throughout the course of time, some of those things begin to clear up.
You know, my boss, Trevor, he was working at Johnson County the last few years, was a local junior college in the area and was working with different teams. And then here we do a lot more like what we were talking about with Cressy. We do individualized programs where we get guys on force plates and do movement screenings and stuff like that.
My time was brief at Johnson County. Here at Top Flight, we could get into all the, you know, the details of, you know, with the force plates and the specific, you know, movement assessments that we would do. I feel like we could kind of the program a lot better doing the individual approach. But then once you get to the team setting, you just got like an hour to train 20 to 30 kids. Some of them want to be there. Some of them don't want to be there. You got injuries that, you know, come up and then you have to try to change things on the fly. So being in that team setting, it definitely can kind of difficult, but for the most part, it's just kind of trial and error. And, you know, you're just trying to keep the kids healthy and actually make training fun for them at the same time, too. So,
yeah, when I was coaching at college, we'd have like 50 guys in a weight room, and it's just a lot. And you're just trying to get guys to move better and get stronger. And the big thing, especially like a Judico that I was coaching at, you're getting 18, 19 year old guys that may or may not have a lot of weightlifting experience. So you're just trying to be like, hey, we just need to get stronger.
Yeah. When I think about like the foundation, which people always talk about, you can't build a big house if you don't have a strong foundation, right? When I think about the foundation, some of the things that are important to me is relative strength. So like you said, like you have to build up a baseline level of strength. And the reason that is because when you get strong or you get strong enough, whatever that is and that threshold is, there's just so many downstream benefits to it. For example, it's going to help preventing injury. It's going to help hitting the baseball harder or producing more force. There's just a lot of good downstream things that happen physically once you get strong. And then number two, I'd say movement quality. And movement quality is kind of a broad term. But for me, in a general sense, movement quality is moving in three planes of motion. So up and down, sagittal, side to side, frontal, and rotational, transverse plane. We're moving in those ranges of motion consistently. We're doing bilateral and unilateral lifting. We're doing our pressing and pulling, so like upper body movements in different vectors, so horizontal but also vertical. When I think of movement quality, for lack of a better term, checking all those boxes throughout a week or a month program, and I feel pretty confident as long as our technique is good that we have a good sense of movement quality. I think foundation and then relative strength and movement quality within that.
What are those consistent challenges that continue to pop up with every athlete, specifically for you with being on the strength and conditioning side?
Easy answer here for me right off the bat is a language barrier and speaking Spanish. So obviously, like I said, I was born and raised in New Jersey, and I have some Puerto Rican heritage, and my dad is Puerto Rican, but you know, I don't speak a ton of Spanish up until recently getting into pro ball. And what you realize when you get into professional baseball as a young coach, a lot of the lower levels within the system is, you know, 80% plus pretty much Latin Americans who only speak Spanish. So that is probably the biggest challenge. And basically, I don't have a really good method to give you, but I just put my nose down and I really tried to learn Spanish for the past 3 or 4 years. And now I can consider myself almost fluent. So that's one. That's probably the biggest challenge, just speaking personally. And then number two, and I'll be kind of vulnerable with you guys on this one, and Will knows me as a person a little bit better. I'm a charismatic guy and I like to run around. I like to have energy and I like to scream and I like to be quote unquote that rah-rah guy. Like when you hear people talk about that, like I like that. That is me. I'm not forcing that. That's just kind of who I am. And then being in a big organization with front office, and at the end of the day, it's a business and there's hundreds of millions or if not more dollars flowing around. You have to understand that like I am going to be who I am and I'm charismatic. But at the same time, you have to hold a level of professionalism. And that balance, I've realized, is a challenge, a personal challenge for me. And it's taken a lot of reflection and thought to kind of work through it and what makes the most sense.
Those are actually really, really good thoughts that you bring up. Honestly, not at all what I expected the answer to be, but those are some amazing, very eye-opening challenges that probably are really common throughout the baseball industry. Trevor, Zach, what about you guys on the strength and conditioning?
I would say my biggest challenge is buy-in from the athletes, especially starting off, just because a lot of kids don't have much training experience. A lot of them haven't stuck to a plan more than like 6 months. So actually teaching the athletes how to train correctly and them realizing that that little bro lift that they got off TikTok is not the right way to train athletically or that's going to help get them to their goal. So
I shouldn't be doing what the Liver King does on Instagram?
No, hell no. Hell no. But yeah, just buy in and teaching them how to be professionals when it comes to lifting and just letting them know that, hey, like this is the right way to train. And you know, once they see the results and stick to it for a while, the buy-in gets better. But I would say that's probably the main one that I see, at least starting off.
Yeah, I think the other one too is just we have a lot of kids that lift at school. And so sometimes it's not super organized. And also when you get a 16-year-old kid, communication is usually not their greatest strength. So sometimes they'll get through stuff and you'll be like, hey, what's going on with your dumbbell bench today? You're doing quite a bit less. You're not moving as fast before. Oh, I already benched today. And it's like, tell me that and we'll change it. And then for the older guys, the college and the pro guys, I think it's more getting them to understand less is more, or maybe mindset shifts on, we don't need to lift super heavy anymore. Like, you're already there. Or if you're in season, hey, one lift a week is probably enough right now. You're not 22 anymore. This is probably what you need to do. The goals. Nice. Maybe you can talk about Caleb Marquez. Caleb is, in Frank's words, brick shit house. He's huge. He's 200 pounds and all muscle. I'm like, trying to get his mindset to change from like, hey, we don't need you to squat like 500 pounds anymore. We're swinging a 32-ounce bat and you're throwing a 5-ounce ball. So we've got to change from, we're not power lifters. We're trying to do force production and learn how to move weight quickly.
Yeah. With Caleb, he's kind of different animal, different breed. It's kind of trying to reach that happy medium with Caleb. Just letting him know that, hey, our goal isn't to be curling, 80-pound dumbbells anymore. Instead of you getting crazy strong and us loading your spine up with a bunch of weight, let's get you explosive, get you moving quicker, get you more mobile. He loves to do his bodybuilding lifts and stuff, so he can be a little stiff at times. So mainly for him is just to continue to work on this mobility and get his athleticism up. Trying to relay that message to him constantly because he wants to revert back to his old ways sometimes. But once you start to see his results and everything, he'll snap out of it for the time being.
Victor, what about for you? Because I've been in the affiliated world for a while. Obviously not the last couple of years, but I was with different orgs, and it always blows my mind because you have the guys like the John Carlos Stantons and those guys who are just gym freaks. One guy who jumps out in my mind is Tyler O'Neill. The guys just live in the weight room, and it translates really well to the field. And then you've got other guys like Bartolo Colon, who's just not a physical specimen. He is in his own right. Like, he's talented. There's no doubt about it. But like, I've played with plenty of guys that are, they either live and die in the weight room or they are allergic to the weight room, but they just play baseball. How hard is it with the job that you're doing to make sure that everybody's getting what they need? And you're also kind of keeping them happy with, like, maybe they don't want to get a lift in that day, but they go out there and they're one of your better players.
Yeah, I want to jump off of kind of what Trevor said too about what is too strong, and you getting these meathead guys in the weight room and trying to have them understand like sports performance and baseball performance. There's a difference there. And just to give you a little bit of story on my career, I talked about learning from my failures. During my career, I was pretty much the strongest guy on my college baseball roster throughout my career. And I was never hitting the most home runs or never hitting the most doubles. So I was like, okay. They tell you to get strong so you could hit for more power, but I'm as strong as it gets, at least with my team and what I'm seeing, but I'm not hitting for any power. So like, what's going on? And I came to learn that like, there's this idea of a force velocity curve. Like, you have the force side where you lift max strength and you have velocity on the other end, and velocity is essentially top speed sprinting and fast movements. And I was always training the force side, always trying to lift heavy weights. I'd hit the balls harder. And what I came to realize is like, you have to kind of surf that curve. Yeah, max strength stuff is important, but also you need to throw med balls and you need to do jumping variations and you need to sprint throughout the week. And when you have that kind of holistic approach to training different adaptations or different things, you realize like, now I can produce force more effectively on the baseball field or in my sport. I learned that during my baseball career, and it's really important to try to relay that message to some guys that are just like, no, lift heavy, lift all the time. Like, no, there's kind of a method to this. And if you buy into it, you're going to see the results on the field. And then what you said about being in affiliate baseball and having different types of athletes, like different archetypes is what I'd call them. An important thing, and Trevor mentioned earlier, a guy comes in talking about a TikTok video or something or other, right? Like, when I try to look at the positive first. So like, when an athlete comes in, like, they have something that's probably wrong or probably not going to work for them, but something they're interested in. Like, I'm going to first be like, hey, I'm actually super happy. Like, you're engaged with weightlifting and like looking at stuff on your own. Like, that's really cool. And like, then from there, how can I incorporate what they brought to me into their program? Even if it's not the same thing, or like, hey, they brought me a video of some dude, I don't know, doing a knees over toes type thing. And like, hey, you're 6'10". That's probably not going to work for you. Let's try to do this instead. That's my take on it. I want to address the positive, and I like that they're engaged in the training process. But now let me take what they gave me and try to fit it into their program and what they're trying to do. And I think that builds some buy-in too, because when they bring stuff to the table and I use it, it's like, well, dang, I'm kind of a part of like my plan. And, you know, they get some buy-in from that.
Like a lot of the pro guys that I program for, I always ask them, you know, like, what are some things that you like to do or things that you've had, you feel like have made you successful in the past? So, you know, Will, so we'll use Will, like last off season, whenever we were doing his ramp up for the season, you know, I was like, you know, what are the things you like to do? Will, what are the four things that you love to do in the weight room? You can answer. Go ahead, big fella.
Squats, RDLs, rows, and bench.
So we made sure the variations that he wanted to do that. And obviously he's really strong. And so it was like, hey, we need to velocity based train you. We need to make sure your body's moving quicker so that we can make sure we're good to go. Like whenever you start throwing live down in spring training and all that, but kind of giving him some freedom, like, hey, we're going to make sure some of your auxiliary lifts, you can lift heavy here. I know you want to do that. And we talked about this on earlier podcasts, but I think in my experience, like that just gives that buy-in to the athlete, especially when they're older, when they kind of know some things that they like to do and don't like to do, and maybe some stuff that's made them successful.
I 100% agree with that. And another thing it makes me think of is like when you're talking about different athletes and different guys coming in, to a certain extent, you have to be a chameleon, right? A chameleon changes colors based on the surface it's on. So like as a person, I try to be a chameleon in a lot of ways, because you'll have one guy like Will that wants to get in the weight room all the time and wants to do this stuff. And obviously that's what I want. Like that's my job. That's what I do. I'm like, yeah, let's do that. And then you have other guys. It's like, yeah, I'm going to skip conditioning for 2 days and I'll see you in the weight room like next week. So you have to just have to understand how to navigate those relationships. With Will, it's for a guy like that, it's pretty easy. It's more so trying to tone him back and find the right exercises that work and having pretty high level conversations about exercise. And for the other guy, it's like build a relationship, try to make him smile, try to make him laugh, talk about his family, and then maybe one day he'll roll into the weight room because he's just trying to talk to you. Next thing you know, he's doing like lateral sled drags or something. Like those are two different ways to go about it. And I think trying to be a chameleon helps navigate.
I'm going to switch gears for a second here in terms of like you being with the Rays. Everything that I've kind of known, and maybe Shane, you can back me up right here, from the pitchers that we know within the Rays organization, you guys have always been on the cutting edge of getting the most out of the guys that you have within the organization and being the organization that cracks the code as far as the pitching development. What do you think, based on what you've seen with your time in the organization, sets you apart?
I'd say a big thing I noticed when I got to the Rays was we obviously have a pitching department like every other MLB organization. And just listening to some of the things we do, I can't, you know, divulge too much information about company property and stuff, but I get there early on. And I realized, whoa, I've never seen people talk about sequencing. I've never seen people talk about pitch types and pitch profiles and tunneling like this. You hear those buzzwords and you'll see Pitching Ninja talk about them on Twitter and stuff, but it's different. When you have a presentation from someone and they're really breaking it down and then they're trying to relate it to exercise or what we're doing in other departments, it's like, whoa, this is collaboration. This is kind of how it happens. And to bounce off that, I got my first intro to that when I was at Cressy. All the movement assessment and all the stuff they did there, that whole process is very fluid, meaning that it's not only strength coaches, but it's pitching coaches, it's massage therapists, it's PTs that are all involved in the process of communication, ultimately making a plan for the athletes. That was a big eye-opening moment when I started to see what our pitching staff looks like.
So all the pieces kind of fit together.
Yes.
Is what you're saying.
I think it works really well. You're always going to have your struggles and stuff.
Yeah.
And also to say, I've only been with the Rays, so not having other perspectives limits me in certain ways, and I understand that. But just being that I've been here for 4 years now and seeing it, I think we do a really good job at collaborating and working as a team for the athletes.
Not that I'm going to put you on the spot and like call out or promote another organization, but as far as you working with the Rays, do you guys have other organizations that you kind of look at and you say like, okay, like they do a good job too. What kind are they doing and how can we kind of apply that? Or if they're doing something differently, are there?
Yeah. I mean, you just through conversation, you hear some organizations that people think highly of, some being the Yankees, the Dodgers, but at the end of the day, I can only talk about personal experience, like for that question. And like, I think most of the time it works where Like, I get a network of colleagues that I know in the field, and they happen to work for other professional baseball organizations. So I form a relationship with them. We talk about what they do, and we talk about some of their principles and their methods. And then I see what I like, and I take it. And it's not this big thing where I'm, like, thinking about other organizations more so than it is, like, just a natural process of networking and learning.
Yeah.
And I've taken some things, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I can tell you from firsthand example of the Dodgers. I came from the Diamondbacks, and I got picked up by the Dodgers, and the Dodgers were one of the first organizations that were putting the money back into the minor leagues, from what I saw. And all of the food and all the snacks and anything that they got in the clubhouse was all organic, healthy, clean eating. That's what I'm talking about. There are organizations that just get it, and I know the Rays have been one of those organizations.
Yeah, to kind of build off some of those things. You said you were training at like a D3, D2 school. You go to Cressy. Now you're with the Rays. What are some of the most helpful pieces of tech that you use for your athletes?
So the first thing I'll say with this, when we're talking about tech and how we use it in S&C, and I think there's an industry-wide thing. I think we can be more strategic or intentional about the tech we're ultimately purchasing and then trying to use, because I think what happens a lot of times, especially with like big money markets and teams that have a lot of money, is they'll get all this tech. And then what actually ends up happening with the data they're getting is like, well, if we look back a few years from when we got it, we actually haven't made much changes on our athletes. We just are spending a lot of money on this stuff, and it sounds good to have. So I think that's just an important thing, and that's not Rays or professional baseball. That's just, I think, industry-wide. Yeah, I think we have to be intentional about the tech we're getting and what our plan is with it. Just personally, some things that I really like and I think are game changers are GPS monitoring. So for example, Catapult is the big one. Catapult is a system, I'm sure you guys have seen, you're aware, but it's a sports bra, and you put the sensor in there, and it basically tracks all the movements of the athlete throughout the course of activity in the day. You get a really good look at high speed sprinting. You get a really good look at overall yardage or volume covered. You can look at acceleration, deceleration. Depending on the unit, you can look at heart rate. So I think that gives you a really good objective analysis of the workload of the athlete throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the season. And then you could make some nice programming decisions based on that. Another one that I really like, the company Vault, they have a nice battery of different things. The force plates is something that I've been diving into recently, like how can we best impact, you know, athlete development based on the data we're getting, than doing a whatever 4 to 8 week training block and like, did the jumps get better? That's something I'm still learning about. And then the last thing I'd say is I really like their hip adduction, abduction assessments, just to look at the hip complex from a force standpoint. So those are kind of my three tech pieces that just stand out. And there's a bunch of other ones. But that's kind of my big three.
In my opinion, what the tech does is it helps you out as the coach, because it allows you to see without just using the eyeball test, like, are things getting better? And then two, it's a really good way to show, it's like a 12-year-old kid, 14-year-old kid, or a 32-year-old professional athlete like Frank, hey, look, we've been doing this the last 4 weeks, 8 weeks, and these numbers are getting better, so we should probably just keep staying the course of what we're doing. Or it's like, hey, actually, these numbers got better, these got worse, so let's put a little bit more focus on this.
The tech has definitely helped a lot. We added the force plates, and then I think a couple of years ago I got the Dasher laser timers, and goes back to the buy-in aspect. If an athlete comes in day one, we take them through the force plate assessment and the sprint assessment, and they see that, hey, counter movement jump was 18 inches, and then we take them through their first month or 2 months of training in that first phase. And then second time we take through the assessment, his counter movement jump is 23 inches. You know, if an athlete sees that, that's buy-in. You know, they're happy. They want to see that visual feedback. When I first started Top Flight, I didn't have any tech. First, I didn't have any money, so I wasn't going to be able to buy any tech. Adding the lasers and the force plates, it just drives the intent way up. I could tell a kid, hey, go sprint as fast as you can, or move this bar as fast as you can. But if an athlete sees the number or sees their progress going up, it's just like with the, you know, throwing or hitting. If I'm looking at a radar gun, I see my velo is going up, you know, that's going to make me, you know, work a little bit harder. I would definitely say adding all of the tech that we've, you know, incorporated into the athlete's training has definitely helped quite a bit.
Frank, I guess as a player, like when you use those kind of tools in the weight room, do you feel like it helps you as like a competitor, or do you feel like it's just, you know, hey, like this is something I'm doing? Like, do you completely differentiate those things, or do you feel like it translates?
I think kind of looking at it from the competition standpoint is good. I think it can be a little tougher because competition for me is more immediate. And the technology that we're using and the results that we're aiming for aren't necessarily the results you're going to get in 1 week or 1 hour, 1 day. It's on us as coaches to be like, hey, I don't know if you remember, but back 2 months ago, your vertical jump was 18 inches, you know, and then the kid probably doesn't know that, but then today you're like 24 inches.
Yeah.
And then the kid's like, oh, damn, that's sick. Hell yeah. What else you got for me? You know what I'm saying? Same thing with that on the pitching side. We have the data to be able to measure and understand where we're at, but we also can pocket that and kind of come back and revisit that after a while. A lot of the guys on the pitching side, when we're doing our pitching program, between now and 2 months or from when we started, these kids are warming up and they're like, shoot, that was like my third throw at a step into, and that's already my PR from 3 months ago. Shit must be working. That's kind of like that long-term thing. Cause it is really easy as an athlete. And just, I think as anybody who kind of trains or does anything at a high level, I'm sure everybody in this room is the same way, that you kind of lose track of the bigger picture because you're so focused on making sure you're doing everything that you need to do that day. But then when you have these results and you're able to go back and look at them and you see the big picture and you see that trend line going up in the right direction, you get a little bit more fired up. Have you seen the same thing on your side?
Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is having kids kind of understand the process behind what they need to do to get to their goals. I mean, we'll have kids come out and throw on somebody, hey, you know, I'll throw 10 miles an hour harder. And they expect that to be almost an overnight thing, to where, you know, if they put 2 or 3 weeks of work in, they expect to be 10 miles an hour harder, but they don't understand the small steps that it takes to get there. And so using that technology stuff, you know, whenever we get to our bullpen, let's say, you know, week 3, we're, you know, up 5 miles an hour, but they're still upset because they weren't at that 10. But we kind of show them that, hey, your assessment, you were, let's say, you know, 80, and now, you know, 3 weeks later, up to 85, and then they're making those small steps to get to that bigger goal. And that's the biggest thing that kind of helps us data-wise, whether it's TrackMan or Rapsodo or the Stalker Radar, is just having that objective data to show them that we are making progress, and then just have them, like you were saying, just buy into that and understand, trying to be a little more process driven that way, not just try to have this big overall goal they're trying to hit within, you know, a week or two, but understand what it takes to get there. It's gonna be big.
Most of the time when we're on the pitching side and we have a kid that jumps 5 miles an hour and he's also working out over on the side, on the top flight side with you guys, we can literally go and coordinate with Zach and whatever and be like, hey, this guy was up 5 miles an hour today. And Zach will be like, oh, it's funny because he's squatting like 20 more pounds a day and his vertical's also up 5 inches.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, now you can take it to the kid and be like, listen, this is what progress looks like.
I did this the other day with Bob. I was like, hey, what are you kind of working on the pitch side? He's like, this, and this. And what I can do is I can be like, all right, we're going to do these med ball throws as part of their explosive work or their warm up to reinforce what's going on the pitching side, just so that what they're doing in the weight room ties directly into what they're doing on the mound. Or if it's like, how much communication are you in with the hitting coach, with the pitching coach, with the coordinators and all that? Like,
yeah, I'd say daily basis. Obviously, the bigger level guys, more leadership positions like coordinators and directors and things, maybe a little bit less. I think we do a good job. I think when you talk about communication and in a big organization, like, you have to systemize certain things, especially when it comes to communications. Looking back on the past year, if I had like average number of meetings per day, average meetings is probably above 2 or 3. I'm having meetings with different departments and different people throughout the course of the day to make sure we're systemizing. We're setting this time to collaborate and make sure we're putting the athlete's best interest first. So, like, I think it's important to systemize. And to answer your question, like, that's happening, at least personally, on a daily basis.
I remember watching a presentation with Dan Heefner. He's the Dallas Baptist head coach. And he talked about how everything they do with their hitters, they reinforce in the weight room, because he wants them to know what we're doing in here is directly affecting how you move as a hitter. And I think that was one thing that clicked in my brain, like how you were talking about whenever you were, you know, in college, like, I was always the strongest guy. Like, why am I not hitting like that? And when you're 12, you don't really know what you don't know. And you're like, hey, I'm supposed to do this thing because they told me this is what I'm supposed to do. As opposed to, like, when you're 30 and you're a professional and you're getting paid to play. It's like, okay, what I'm doing it here, I have to maximize so I can maximize what I have out there.
Exactly. I like using as a coaching tool is actually bringing up their pitching footage, like live footage of their delivery, or even a hitter live footage from a game, like a hard take or like a double in the gap or whatever. And then using that as I'm coaching, whether I'm relating an exercise or a med ball drill or a positional breathing drill, and being like, see this position where your hip is, or see how your arm is in this delivery. What if we do this with your exercise to try to mimic it or to try to open this space up or whatever it might be? I found that to be a really good tool because the guys are starting to think, okay, these things I do in the weight room can translate to the field.
Like when we get a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, really, my mindset is just to get them to want to come back. Hey, I want you to like doing this. And I want you to fall in love with the weight room. Because I think for pitching and hitting, you're coaching a kid doing that. Odds are they want to be there because it's fun and they like to do that. Playing games, they can directly see, oh, I practiced this with my hitting coach. And now I hit a double in the game. That makes you want to come back. But it's hard to explain, like, hey, when I do this trap bar deadlift, it's going to help you throw hard. It's just hard to process.
Yeah, you basically said it. Is teaching them the basics and teaching them how to lift and move their bodies the right way. Because they're going through a lot of things. They're growing. They're going through puberty. So just kind of setting the foundation for them, getting their base strength up and trying to get them to fall in love with the process and like doing it. Because if they don't like doing it, you'll definitely know for sure pretty quick. So just getting them to fall in love with it and fall in love with the process.
That is even if it's not like a sport specific thing, like living a natural, healthy lifestyle, like it's good for kids to understand that your body is something special and you should treat it treat it well. And if you don't, you're going to end up eating 8 Quick Trip sandwiches in a weekend, you know, and it's going to be shit for your body.
I think the off season is always fun because you can push guys. Hey, they're not throwing on the mound every day. They're not playing in games as a position player. Like if you're an everyday guy in the big leagues, in the minor leagues, you're playing 120 to 160 games. And so obviously you got to back off a little bit in the weight room or a lot of bit.
Speaking from personal experience, for some reason, I always feel way worse in the off season. And then I get into the season and things become simplified. And you might be able to disagree here, but when you're a strength coach in the season and you're working for an organization, I would imagine that your entire job is just making sure that they're getting on the field and continue to play every day. Am I right?
100% right, though. The biggest goal in season, I think the best mark of a good strength conditioning coach, obviously maybe depends a little bit on the setting, but a good mark of a strength conditioning coach is availability, how good you are at keeping guys on the field. And there's a lot of variables that go into it, but I think just looking at it like bird's eye view, if guys can be ready to play every day for 162, then I say I did a pretty good job this year. That's a big rock for me. So kind of just talking in season, I'm going to talk a little bit like periodization and programming. In season, the way I think about things is like you guys said, it's keeping guys on the field and really I think readiness more so than anything else. And readiness is a bit basically how well you're firing, whether it be like muscular or soft tissue or central nervous system, how well you are firing on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis to ultimately perform on the field. That's a big thing, but I really do think throughout a 8-month baseball season or longer, you can get better at certain qualities, which is why sometimes when people use the word maintain, I think about how the context in which they're using it, because you definitely want to maintain certain things, but there's abilities to get better. For example, a young Latin American baseball player that's 18 years old. Yeah, you're going to play a lot of games this year because you need to get better at baseball, but you're also going to lift a lot this year because you can't get better at baseball unless you lift a lot and get bigger and stronger. Sometimes you have to lay out your priorities in your development process for in-season training. But the biggest thing is keeping guys available and trying to monitor and optimize for daily and weekly readiness. And then a little bit on off-season, because I know you guys asked. I feel as if every off-season I'm thinking something else and doing something different, just as my learning process. But something that I've kind of hitched my bandwagon to, which is maybe some people will be mad at me for this, but it's simple and I've seemed to have some success with it for the past few years, is NSCA standards, the CSCS, and I know a lot of us here probably know that certification and what it means. I follow a lot of those guidelines from a general perspective for off-season training and throughout the course of the years. For example, a baseball guy finishes his season. The first thing I'm going to do is an active recovery period for about 2 weeks. Where we're going to promote blood flow. We're not going to do heavy loads. There's going to be a lot of mobility. We're going to be moving in different movement patterns. We're kind of going to open things up and restore some things for the first 2 weeks. And then after that is where I'd get into like my general preparatory phase or GPP, where it's higher volume, but lighter weights. We're getting back into the flow of the weight room. Potentially we start to put some muscle mass. We start to feel strong again. And then after that, I go to hypertrophy or muscle building phase. Because once we do that and we build muscle for a period of time, then we could actually display that newfound muscle into force and power, which is the things that we're really chasing. Once we get to the field later on. And then after hypertrophy, we get to the strength work and the power work and all the fun and fancy stuff, where you have a lot of options you could play with. But just that scheme of active recovery, GPP, hypertrophy, strength, and then speed and power kind of taking you into spring training, I found as an off-season periodization scheme for baseball players to be pretty effective. And that's something I've kind of stuck with.
I've programmed in season for some relievers, and I feel like those guys are tough because your schedule is, it's not planned, I guess, is how I would put it. Whereas like if you're a starting pitcher, I know you're going every 5 days, every 6 days, whatever it may be for your rotation. And then also like a position player, if you're playing every single day at third base, you know, having guys do 3 days of lifting a week may not be the best.
What you started to talk about at the end of there is like what I would consider like workload. Like once you get a good idea, I probably don't even have a good idea myself because I'm always learning and I think I'm wrong most of the time. Once you get an idea of workload and you have GPS monitoring, like I was talking about, to kind of back it up and give you objective numbers, you can start to understand like, okay, this guy's playing third base every day, like his workload or the amount of accelerations, decelerations, the amount of high speed sprinting he's doing is higher. So he might be a guy that only needs one or two per week in terms of like total body lifts. And then, all right, let's see our other guy who's kind of a platoon guy. He'll play two or three times a week. He'll get some pinch hit opportunities. Man, let's just look at his yardage per week and his high speed running per week is way down compared to my everyday guys. So we need to make sure we're supplementing that throughout the course of the week off the field, not only to like make sure he's getting better in things, but also to make sure like if there's a change in roster or whatever, and he's got to play every day, he's ready to do it. Like we're doing a disservice to those low inning athletes if we're not training them accordingly off the field when they're not playing every day. Because then when they get on the field, it's like they're going to be at a disadvantage. So I think that's an important thing when you talk about different guys and workloads and like high inning groups, low inning groups. So I think that's important. And then the difference between like starters, relievers, position players, what I've kind of gone to with like bullpen guys or relievers and then position players is trying to just set a structure. It gets pretty difficult when you like want to communicate with them every day and like, let's pick a day this today, or if you feel good today. Now like that gets too wishy-washy. Instead, let's try to go Wednesday and Saturday, or let's try to go the day we get in from the road and one other day. Like if you set that structure early on, you end up being consistent long-term. And then starters is kind of easier because they have their schedule and that's all through the pitching staff and stuff. So like you can work around their lifts, whether they like to do post-game lifts or day after, you can kind of figure out the week from there.
I know you talked about the challenge of speaking Spanish and training. Have you been able to get down to the Dominican complex and work down there?
Yeah, the DR is, man, it is a monster. It's a machine. It's a big operation down there. And yeah, I've only gone 1 week in my Tampa Bay Rays career, but it left a big mark on me. And I always think about it and I always remember it. So yeah, I was able to go down there. That was last year. And then also speaking Spanish with the guys in the States and doing Spanish lessons on my own, I've, you know, gotten pretty good.
It looked like you also spent some time in Colombia training.
Yeah, so that was a really cool opportunity. It was a Rays-sponsored cultural immersion program is what they called it. And essentially, I went down to Medellin, Colombia for 2 weeks, and I went to a Spanish school for pretty much all morning and afternoon throughout the week. And then essentially, our education advisor was with us. And then we'd do like cultural experiences in the afternoons and the evenings, whether it be going to dinner, seeing different parts of Colombia, going to soccer games and stuff like that. So that was super cool. And just since you asked about baseball, I didn't get a lot of baseball experience per se, but I came to realize there's a lot of international scouting and professional baseball that goes through Colombia. And I'm not really sure why, because it's mainly Venezuela, DR, Puerto Rico, Cuba. But like the Marriott that was downtown in Medellin, apparently there's a bunch of scouts that go in and out of there. So that's a thing.
Might be because no one wants to stay in Venezuela.
It's a tough spot right now.
Yeah. I had the chance to play in Venezuela one winter, and it is a beautiful country, but it is wildly, wildly corrupt and dangerous. So I think most people will come to Colombia since it's the neighboring country and then pop over and do some scouting and then come back.
That makes a lot of sense.
We have a lot of middle school, high school kids. We have a lot of college and pro guys too, but what would be a couple big things that you would recommend to those age level of athletes?
I'm going to start with a little bit of math. Let's say you're a freshman in high school and you're looking to get into the weight room for the first time. And you're not really sure how to start, but maybe you found a program or a coach you trust, which is important. Let's just say you do your off-season training, which a lot of kids these days that are serious are doing. And I think you have a huge opportunity to surpass your competition if you just do some math on something. Let's say you do 2 times a week lifting throughout the course of your 4 years. You have 52 weeks a year. So I'm going to times 52 by 2. That's 104. That's 104 training sessions per year, and we're going to times that by 4. So you get over 400 training sessions in just high school if you stick to and are consistent with 2 times a week training. If you just do that math and understand, like, be consistent. You're serious about this. You want to commit to the weight room 2 times a week. Do that throughout the course of high school, and you're going to have over 400 training sessions. And when you look at some of your competition and what some other kids are doing, that just blows them out of the water. So it's able to give you a really good foundation and put you on a pretty much a platform to go into college or to go into pro ball with a really good foundation. So that's my big thing. If we're talking like strength conditioning and physical stuff, just do the math. And if you start early and you're consistent, that stuff really compounds into the rest of your career.
We definitely see that. We have guys that have been super consistent for years and make massive jumps. We have a bucket of guys that will be really consistent maybe in the off season, then disappear in the spring and summer, then show back up in the fall. And I think consistency is something we've really talked about on the podcast a lot. Is if you want consistent results, you got to have consistent training, whether it's on the field or in the weight room. That's all we got for today.
Thanks again, Victor. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Good luck this year in Montgomery. Enjoy the wet and warm weather down there in spring training. I know we all wish we were down there with you because it's 20 degrees outside today, but it's been great talking to you. Thanks for dropping some knowledge on us. And that's it for another episode of Backfield Banter. Like and subscribe.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.